anti-police riot in the middle of the summer. Gay people in Earl's Court who were routinely persecuted by the police, you know, on one, you know, hot summer night, decided they too had had enough of being pushed around. And after that, all those struggles go from being, you know, underground to, you know, moving towards the, you know, the centre of our politics, if you like. And it happened. So those are, if you like, some of the big deal ways things are happening. Even bigger yet is we have a Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, who was, you know, the greyest of grey men.
And it's the heat that brings these people out and makes for a very striking contrast with a politics that seems hidebound in the moment. John, I'm really sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, but Heatwave, the summer of 1976, Britain at boiling point, sounds like a fascinating book that speaks to this already pretty hot summer as much as it does the summer of 49 years ago. That's all from me today, I'm afraid. Thanks very much for your company this afternoon. I'm back tomorrow from 1 o'clock. Fee Glover and Martha Lane Fox are next here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much indeed, Patrick. We are feeling hot, hot, hot. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Martha Lane Fox here on Times Radio.
Coming up on the show today, how will the government meet its housing targets? Michael Gove, Lord Gove these days, will be here to share his opinion. Six police chiefs have timed up to write to the Times today about what they call a risk to justice if the government doesn't make proper investment in policing. We'll be speaking to one of the six. And what goes on at a £7,000 dating boot camp? Do we really want to know? I'm not really sure. Well, we're going to find out. Speaking to a journalist who's not only been, but he's worked at one. And Succession creator Jesse Armstrong will join us after 3:30 to talk about his new film, Mountainhead, that takes on the tech oligarchy.
And it will be good. All of that happens after the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Less than half of the British public supports junior doctors going on strike. The BMA has begun balloting the medics, now known as resident doctors, for strike action that could last 6 months. The union's leaders say they want the equivalent of a 29% pay rise. But a survey by YouGov suggests only 39% of people support more hospital walkouts. Last summer, that figure was more than half at 52%. The Deputy Prime Minister says that having fewer criminals serving sentences in prison is not going soft on crime. Angela Rayner's promising people will be safe despite warnings from the heads of MI5, Scotland Yard and the National Crime Agency. Bosses at six police forces say the plans to ease overcrowding in jails in England and Wales will mean added pressures on their services. Craig Guildford is Chief Constable of West Midlands Police.
If you take a force such as my own, we are still 700 officers short of what we had in 2010. Those numbers are needed to increase visibility, to respond to calls for service, and to respond to some of the changing types of crime that we deal with today.
Dominic Cummings says the Conservative Party may never recover from its drubbing at last year's general election.
It's quite possible that the Tories have just kind of crossed the event horizon and actually aren't salvageable. Like, everyone sort of assumes that because they've always been around, then like somehow there must be at least one last chance for them to turn things around. But it's possible that that chance doesn't exist.
Boris Johnson's former chief advisor has also told Sky News that Kemi Badenoch will be gone as Tory leader within a year. He contends that Nigel Farage could be prime minister because the old political system is, in his words, just so completely broken. The government has rejected a call from Sadiq Khan to make the possession of a small amount of cannabis legal. A commission set up by the London mayor concluded it should remain illegal to import and distribute the drug, but not to have some for personal use. Opponents argue the harm associated with cannabis use is not fully understood. Ed Davis is the research director at the Centre for Social Justice.
We spent about a year travelling the world recently to look at places that had legalised and decriminalised drugs, and we don't have a good story to tell from anywhere. And in fact, again, Sadiq Khan's own report says that. It says that there isn't an example of a good jurisdiction who has done this well yet. So quite how it's come to the conclusion that decriminalisation is the answer is slightly beyond me.
A review of the closure of Heathrow in March has found the airport made the right decisions. A report by former Transport Secretary Ruth Kelly says alternative choices on the day would not have materially changed the outcome. A fire at a substation near the West London site forced it to close for almost a day. And the UK has recorded its sunniest spring on record, with 4 days of the season still to go. The Met Office says we had around 630 hours of sunshine across the country between March and May. That's already exceeded the previous record by 4 hours set during the 2020 COVID lockdown. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive.
And it is 4 minutes past two. Welcome to Wednesday. Off we go. Mulf and me, we're here until four.
Careful how you say that.
Exactly. Please. It is a bumper show for you. It's just what your midweek afternoon needs. We're going to start with a chat about housing with Lord Gove, Michael Gove. That's in just a couple of moments' time. In a stunning gear change, we'll then consider attending a dating boot camp where you can train to be a high-status individual in your own love life, building a social circle of, and I'm quoting here, heart-stopping women and elite men. That's according to the organiser, who will charge you $7,500 to do this in the Nevada desert. Would you? Well, I don't know. We're talking to an author who embedded himself anonymously in the boot camp, and he has got some rather terrifying things to tell us about the people who attended it. We'll also consider whether it's worth becoming a high-worth individual at all. If you're going to get kidnapped, violent attacks targeting in particular crypto investors and their executives are on the rise. Several cases have been reported in France and in the US in recent weeks, so we'll talk about that in this hour of the programme too. Sustainability in tech is on our agenda today, and we welcome Jesse Armstrong to the show, the man who gave us Succession. He's turned his attention to the Tech Bro Network too. His latest work is a film all about them, which Martha has watched. What would your verdict? Turn yourself into a film critic now for about a minute.
My capacity as world-renowned film critic.
Yes.
I obviously came at this with some baggage for you because of having been somewhat on the edges of the tech bro world as a board member of Twitter for a long time. So I was already gritting my teeth as I saw these four men in black designer outfits getting out of their SUVs as they arrive in a mountaintop resort to have 24 hours together, as they do every year, to celebrate just how phenomenally successful they are. And I think we can safely say I was right to grit my teeth. And by the end, I really didn't want them ever to be let out of the mountain resort, which they had been trapped in for a while. It's good. It's his classic satirical biting writing. It jumps from laugh out loud to very dark consequence pretty quickly. I might have knocked a few minutes off it. I think it's a very interesting piece, set piece. And I think that it could make its point perhaps in a slightly shorter amount of time. But beyond that, I really enjoyed it.
And it's such a good thing for us to be able to peer into that world, isn't it? Because actually, I think so much of it has advanced without any of us really understanding who these people are. They've created, you know, quite a barrier between us and them, not least because of their enormous wealth.
Yeah, their enormous wealth. And I think the thing that I really recognised in his work and his writing, which he says he garnered a lot from just interviews and podcasts, not necessarily bumping close up to these people, is just how much they really do believe they can design the world again, and that if it was left to them, with ones and noughts, they would be able to do an incredible job at running countries, companies, systems of any kind.
It's just not working, though. I mean, it is working in terms of the balance sheet, but in terms of human pain,
of course
it's really not working.
Of course it's not.
Well, how brilliant. So Jesse Armstrong is our guest. We will play out that interview after 3:30 this afternoon. Chris Stokel-Walker is here too, our favourite tech journalist, so we will talk about all things tech. We've really got a theme going today, haven't we? I wonder why. Okay, off we go. It's 7 minutes past two.
Should we have the same rules for building 10 houses as building 100? And how much should we really be worrying about the environmental impact of building any at all? Ministers are reviewing biodiversity net gain rules, which make developers compensate for how much nature is lost while building. They say it'll boost small house builders, though some environmental groups warn it could lead to damaging developments. Lord Gove, Michael Gove as was housing minister under both Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. He really knows this subject well, and we're delighted to have him on the programme now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Martha. Hi, good afternoon.
So Angela Rayner says she's getting Britain building. You must have a big smile on your face.
Well, I'm a qualified fan of Angela Rayner. I think she's one of the most impressive people in the government, and we certainly need to build more homes. But I do have a profound concern about what's being floated today. Biodiversity not gain, net gain sounds like you know, sort of three pieces of political jargon bolted together, but actually it is a really important policy, one of the most important things, I think, that the Conservative government did in its final years. And it established the principle that when you build new homes, which is a really good thing, we acknowledge that we lose landscape, that we lose wildlife as a result, and that those building new homes should ensure that money is set aside in order to guarantee that elsewhere in the United Kingdom, we enhance landscapes, we create new terrain for wildlife. And if it's the case that these rules are altered, then what I worry is that we will see nature further suffer. And we are one of the most wildlife and nature depleted countries in the world. And it seems to me that you can't have development at any price.
But would you agree that these rules perhaps have become overly bureaucratic and us kind of slowing down the process of building houses, which we know, as you say, is extremely important for us right now?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that we need to make sure that the whole process by which planning consent is granted, by which local authorities or others agree to new homes, definitely needs to be speeded up. But one of the things that we must not do is to let developers off the hook from their environmental obligations. And we all recognise that in building new homes, developers particularly want to go for those greenfield sites where it's easier to build. If you're building in cities, if you're building in brownfield sites, there's more cost in order to remediate the land and to make it safe and so on. So naturally, developers are going to go there. That's fair enough. That's the profit motive. But if we are losing greenfields, and in particular, if we are losing the habitats on which species depend, then we need to make sure that we invest in, for example, making sure that our peatlands or our wetlands are in a healthier condition in order to ensure that we have proper biodiversity. And, you know, one of the critical things is, in a country like the United Kingdom, yes, there is a lot of land which we can develop, but it is also the case that if you look at everything from our population of songbirds to the nature of our endangered species to the way in which this natural capital has been eroded, we have got to put nature back in the heart of policymaking.
Everybody can think of stories that have been in the press, I think, over the last few months about, you know, people going to ridiculous lengths to protect a spider or to stop something being built because of a bat having made a camp somewhere. How do you approach that trade-off when you're designing effective policy? Because it is complicated, isn't it? And it can become a bit of a caricature that somebody's had to do an incredible amount of work just for one animal that's living in the corner of the field where they might be trying to do something relatively discreet.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we've inherited a set of rules which do mean that a single jumping spider or a single endangered species, newts, of course, are the ones that are most often cited. And to be fair, Britain is the home of, some people might find this sort of slightly sort of eccentric point, but it is the home for most of Europe's newt population. But even if you have a situation, which is absurd, where you have development thwarted because of what's perceived to be one particular species or one particular colony of bats, that doesn't mean you should throw the baby out with the bathwater. We do need to streamline this approach. We do need to look at ways, and we have been looking at ways, in which you can acknowledge that even in habitats where there are endangered species, you can build, provided the money is made available in order to ensure that nature elsewhere is enhanced and that new habitats are found. So, yes, there are infuriating aspects to the way in which bureaucracy operates at the moment, but getting rid of the obligation to think about the environment and biodiversity when we're developing, if that's the road the government is going down, I think is the wrong one.
Minette Batters, who's also a new member of the Lords and ex-head of the Farmers Union, as you'll know, thinks that every new housing development should have an allotment. I've never had an allotment. Have you, Michael? Do you think this is a good idea?
I've had gardens, not an allotment. I think that's probably too prescriptive. So I think allotments and indeed gardening and the closer that we are to nature overall is a good thing. One thing, though, that I do think we need with every new development is a swift brick. Again, listeners may not be familiar with this, but swifts, which again are an iconic British species, used to nest in traditional buildings in the crevices and in the because of the way in which our buildings used to be built, there were always opportunities for swifts to nest. Now, because of the way in which we build and the sophisticated designs that we have, we don't have that sort of those nooks and crevices which were vital for swift breeding. But there is a wonderful campaigner called Hannah Bourne Taylor, who's been working with my friend Zach Goldsmith in order to try to persuade developers to have a swift brick in every new home. It would cost only £25 additionally for the cost of every new home. And in so doing, we could help safeguard an iconic British species. So allotments, nice. Swift bricks, really necessary.
But isn't that part of the problem, is that everybody will have their thing? It might be a newt nest, yes. It might be a swift brick, it might be a bat lair, and this kind of incrementalism means that we've ended up back where we were trying to avoid getting away
Absolutely, and that's why there needs to be balance. So on the one hand, you will have some in the development sector who will say that any requirement, any form of regulation, whether that's on building safety or the environment, is a cost. But then just look at the dividends that they pay out. On the other hand, you will have people who will say that the current web of regulation is perfect and mustn't alter. I think the correct position is to say that we need the thoughtful implementation of targeted measures which actually genuinely improve the environment. And in return for developers, paying their fair share in order to enhance the environment, we can speed up the whole process. And actually, the most enlightened developers are very happy to do what they can to support nature and the environment, provided they have swiftness, no pun intended, and certainty in the planning process. And that's the sweet spot. And I actually think that's where Angela Rayner really wants to go. And I hope that's what the conclusion of this consultation leads to.
Switching from the insider house to perhaps to different topics now, I don't think we can have you on the line without talking about Nigel Farage. I know that you said you've respect him in the past. Do you respect the spending pledges he's committed to this week?
No. I do respect him. You've got to respect him because he's been one of the most formidably influential figures in the last two decades of British politics. And I think some of the people who've sneered at him and some of the people who've caricatured him have been unfair to him. However, I think that the press conference that he had yesterday was a holiday from reality. It was fantasy island politics. At the moment, we are spending far more in tax. The international markets, who are bloodless and cynical, phenomena, but they do at least reward virtue and punish vice, are making it more expensive for Britain to borrow because they think that our finances are unsustainable. And he is making a series of promises about tax cuts and benefit increases that we as a country simply cannot afford. There are some criticisms one can make of precisely how the government, I've made them, of precisely how the government is implementing benefit cuts. They could be done more effectively. But for Nigel Farage to suggest that you can fund all this by sacking a few people in HR and going slow on windmill implementation, I'm afraid it is not doing, it's not playing fair by the people who voted Reform, and it can only risk feeding further cynicism about politics overall.
So how do you think your party should play with Reform? Do you think that, for example, I believe Rupert Lowe, the ex-Reform MP, was meeting with Robert Jenrick. Do you think you should welcome in Reform MPs? Is there any other collaborating that you should be doing?
Well, I think the Conservative Party should welcome in people who've voted for Reform or voted Lib Dem or voted Labour. I don't think that you should pronounce an anathema on anyone because of their past political views. People can change, they can repent, they can see the light. So that for me, that is not a problem. But the broader thing, I think, is Kemi Badenoch, when she was elected, said the important thing was to tell the truth. And I completely agree. And I think that there's a growing appetite and constituency in politics for people who will say, I'm terribly sorry, you can't have it all. You cannot have your cake and eat it. That is what Kemi Badenoch and Mel Strong are saying in the last few days. They've been emphasising, and Rob Jenrick too, actually, and I'm not allowed to mention the Daily Telegraph, but in another newspaper, it's not the Times. That's what they've been saying recently, and they're right to.
Well, thank you very much for your views on such a broad set of topics. I have to say, I'm personally going away with a happy picture of you and Angela Rayner holding hands and dancing down Whitehall. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
With some swift circling above.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder, is Michael Gove gone? I just wanted to ask him whether he had the swift bricks in place when he was housing minister. Were they in every single new development? We'll check that out.
Yeah, let's verify that.
Do you have Swift boxes on your house? Because you can put a Swift box on if you don't
have
a brick.
I am going to by tomorrow afternoon.
Excellent. They need to go quite high up. For goodness sake, don't go up the ladder yourself. I don't want any harm to come to you. But you can. You can just put a box there. Yeah. Very simple to get hold of. There are several charities who'll provide them to you. And you can fix them on because Michael Gove is absolutely right. They are a glorious thing. They travel so far to this country, it must be so heartbreaking when they get here and there's no room for them. There's a metaphor going on somewhere. Police have been given more time to question a 53-year-old driver over Monday's incident at the Liverpool Trophy Parade. Seven people remain in hospital. That is news that has just come in to Times Towers. So, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number three, public no longer supports doctors' strikes amid demand for 29% pay rise. That news comes as the British Medical Association polls members on further industrial action. The second most read story is Labour's policies mean we can't survive as farmers in England, so we're moving to France. This is the story of a family of five who are moving from Hertfordshire to the Limousin area, saying that they've been forced out by tax rises, red tape and subsidy cuts. And the most read piece on the Times website this afternoon, fake cocaine killed British tourists in Thailand, inquest told. A British couple, Rebecca Turner and Sam Melnick, were found dead at a hotel in Bangkok alongside a bag of white powder in March of last year. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, let's have a full chorus. Get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. There is a fantastic offer on subscriptions to The Times at the moment, cheaper than The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for only £1. Yes, just £1. And to get the offer, just head to the Times website or app and look for the links to subscribe. The offer ends today at 5 o'clock.
Coming up, I know I'm looking forward to this, what happens at a £7,000 dating boot camp? It's 2:20 and this is Fig Lover and Martha Lane Fox on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at hivehome.com.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
On Breakfast, you're with Rosie Wright and Callum McDonald, in for Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
What are the rules of war? We're going to discuss the laws and how they play out on the battlefield in real life.
Times Radio's Jeff Norcott and the columnist Rebecca Reid will help us make sense of the day's stories.
And JD Vance has a big speech on Bitcoin, so should it be part of your personal portfolio?
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Don't go. No one knows instruments like you do.
A sales assistant at Jen's music store is moving up north, so she needs to find a replacement. A musical whiz who hits all the right notes.
I bet you're going to miss this peace and quiet.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you post a sponsored job, you get a list of candidates whose CVs on Indeed match your description. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
Make 2025 your year of adventure in Fred Olsen Cruise Line Summer Sale. On now at Hayes Travel. You'll raise a glass to a free drinks package on selected sailings. Plus, there are special savings for solo guests too. Sail away with great savings in Fred Olsen Cruise Line Summer Sale. Book by the 25th of June in your local Hayes Travel branch. Conditions apply.
At Aberdeen Asian Income Fund, we understand Asia because we're here. For over 30 years, we've been on the ground, searching for the most compelling and high-performing companies across the Asia-Pacific region. But it's not just about capital growth. Asia offers abundant opportunities for those seeking income. Unlock Asia's potential and invest with us today. Search Aberdeen Asian Income Fund online to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
The Steakhouse Stack, with two layers of delicious beef, crispy onions and peppercorn sauce. It's the kind of McDonald's you take photos of to put pride of place on the mantelpiece. Sure, you'll need to make room, but you remember what your wedding day looked like? The Steakhouse Stack. It's McDonald's, and then some. Available until the 17th of June. Serve from 11 a.m. Subject to availability. Participating restaurants only.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
We've been hearing from former Housing Minister Michael Gove about the government's planning reforms just before the break. So now let's hear from Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner.
We're simplifying the process for houses, if there's under 10 houses built and between 10 and 49. So we're going to simplify that process. We're going to put more expert planners on that process as well, but we won't be compromising on nature.
Is it a price worth paying, though, to deal with the issue of green issues to get more homes built?
Well, I think the process can be really complex. If you're building hundreds of thousands of homes, it's very different to a site of under 10 homes or between 10 and 49. And therefore, we're going to simplify the process on those sites. So this is pragmatism, but we'll be able to protect nature at the same time.
There's a spending review coming. What impact will that have on your department's ability to build your 1.5 million homes by the election?
Look, the Cabinet are all with me. Build, build, build. And we've been making that a priority of this government. You've seen that through the changes in planning reforms that the OBR scored. It's an economic argument as well as an argument that people in this country need housing, and we're determined to build them.
That's Angela Rayner. Thank you for your messages so far this afternoon. 0333 003 2353. Hillary says, big hurrah for Michael Gove banging the drum for Swifts, a small thing which could make a big difference. Right, now what do you think is important when you're creating your online dating profile? Saying you like long walks, Sunday lunches, posting a picture of you in Lycra doing some form of exercise? Well, you might want to know that the rules have changed. Women in the picture means attraction. Women and dog or cat, attraction and comfort. A bathroom mirror selfie means your low status. And if a woman is standing or sitting next to you, then you mustn't lean in. If she leans into you, that's better. And is she pointing her feet towards you, or are you pointing your feet towards her? Well, these are just some of the rules of one man who runs a boot camp for men who want to date well in the desert in Nevada. And in the Times today, James Bloodworth, journalist and author of Lost Boys, A Personal Journey Through the Manosphere, writes about how he embedded himself in the camp. James, you're so welcome on the programme. Blimey, we are curious about this. Tell us more about this camp and what happens in it.
Thank you for having me, first of all. So in a few years ago, 2023, I'd kind of heard about this program already. So men were paying, it was $10,000, which would work out about £7,500 to join this program called the Men of Action Program, which would involve things like a social media boot camp, being taken out to some high-end nightclubs in Las Vegas, and these kind of seminars on how to create a lifestyle that resembled kind of an ostentatious influencer like Dan Bilzerian or even Andrew Tate or someone, one of these people on Instagram who presents this very luxurious lifestyle where they're surrounded by scantily clad women, sports cars, mansions and stuff. That was part of my investigation for my book, because I just found it fascinating but also quite sinister in that It sells these boot camps on the back of fear. So telling men that if they don't create this kind of social media imagery, if they don't present this kind of choreographed thing on social media to the world, they'll never be able to get a girlfriend, or they'll fall behind in today's so-called quote-unquote dating economy.
So they're part of the pickup and seduction industry, which I think to many people would be a new phrase to hear. I mean, we've all been dating for millennia, but the idea that there's a seduction industry, I mean, this is what it's playing into, isn't it?
Yes, it's kind of an offshoot and an evolution of that. So back in 2005, an American journalist, Neil Strauss, brought out a book called The Game, which was an investigation of the pickup community in the United States. It was a hugely popular book, bestseller, and it kind of spawned a bunch of entrepreneurs and masculinity influencers, or hucksters, some people might call them, who kind of really developed that. And today these kind of programs, such as those sold by Andrew Tate, or in this case, a guy called Michael Sartain, they really kind of, it's more social media based. So it's the idea that on the one hand, the world has changed and we live in a kind of post-monogamy world where you need to kind of, you can't just be ordinary anymore. You have to present this cartoonish luxury lifestyle to the world, or you're just going to be kind of left on the shelf. And it really plays on men's fears with that.
I think what's so telling about it as well, and in particular what Sartain is telling these men, is there is nothing really about equality, is there? Just that simple detail of, if you're going to take a selfie with a woman, she's got to lean into you. Her feet have to be pointing towards you. She's got to be scantily clad. She's got to be looking adoringly at you. It is absolutely not, I'd like to meet somebody on my level.
No, that's absolutely right. It's very much a zero-sum kind of social Darwinian view of relations between men and women. So there's very much this view of a gender war where you can't find someone and have an equal partnership with them. It's always kind of this zero-sum thing where one person has to be wielding some kind of power over the other person, even kind of covertly. So even they may not even know they're playing this game. But even kind of monitoring all the variables at all times. I mean, from a male perspective, it must be completely exhausting because you're having to kind of monitor these things at all times. But it really feeds into this very paranoid view of gender relations where you can't just have, like I said, you can't just have an equal relationship with someone. There's always this power struggle going on in the background.
Yeah, that men have got to win. What were the men like who were going to this?
I mean, it's a mixture really, because similarly with, in my book, Lost Boys, I also investigated some of the kind of old school pickup artist boot camps. And you do meet a lot of men on these programs, or I did at least, who basically just need kind of a few pointers in terms of, you know, dress, how they dress and how to kind of improve their social skills. But they've kind of been sold this idea, often through social media, that they're not enough and they need to completely change themselves. They need to basically perform this facade of kind of hyper-masculinity to even stand a chance in today's what they call a dating market. And a lot of this is based on influencers on social media. So I think what social media has done, and dating apps as well, in the last decade, is they've made a lot more people feel that they aren't enough anymore. So they feel like they need to be like these influencers they're seeing on social media, and they kind of buy into that narrative that they feel like they aren't kind of going to be enough for a woman or whatever, or women often feel like that about men. I think that's one way that social media really feeds into these kind of these discourses around insecurity.
It is a whole new language as well, isn't it, James? What is wrong with a bathroom mirror selfie? Why does that make you low status?
Yeah, I mean, the terminology makes people sound like high-value men and low-value men. It does make people sound a bit like eBay collectibles or something. it's slightly absurd. I mean, I can understand there is a sense that presentation is more important now with online dating apps. So something like Tinder and Instagram is basically a catalogue of flesh, where you're presenting yourself as almost a product to the other person. And there is something to be said for, you can do better on those apps if you know how to present yourself in a photo. So not standing in front of a mirror with flecks of toothpaste on it, in a dark room where it looks like you're living inside of a dustbin or something. There is something to be said for that, but this goes to extreme lengths where it's men paying lots of money to have photo shoots where they're stood in front of rented Lamborghinis and inside private jets. Or that wasn't this specific one, but there are men doing that as well. Everything's rented, kind of creating this perfectly choreographed image to the world That's just not real.
Yeah. And the truth is as well, James, is that the actual person is then always going to be something of a disappointment. And you'd do well to set quite a low bar, I think, on the dating apps and let people be pleasantly surprised. It's a really fantastic piece. I really enjoyed reading it. So thank you for coming on and talking about it. If you want to read it too, you can go to The Times today. You can look it up on the app. James Bloodworth is the journalist and his book is called Lost Boys, A Personal Journey Through the Manosphere. Coming up, warnings of a crime wave targeting cryptocurrency millionaires. That's where we'll head next. It's just gone 2:30. Let's get the news with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Merseyside police has been given more time to question a 53-year-old man arrested after a car collided with people at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade. The suspect is being held on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. Police believe the vehicle which struck pedestrians on Water Street on Monday had followed an ambulance crew after a roadblock was temporarily lifted. The Archbishop of Liverpool, John Sherrington, says the city will always stick together.
That memory will traumatise so many people for such a long time. There'll be fear. So we've got to overcome that fear again. But I do know that the people of Liverpool come together with resilience and work together and build again the community. That's what they've always done.
And some more breaking news this afternoon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Mohammed Sinwar, younger brother of the deceased group's leader Yahya Sinwar, has been eliminated. A former surgeon who admitted sexually abusing hundreds of children in France has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Jack Lesquarnec, who's 74, was found guilty of raping and sexually assaulting 299 children. Most of the victims were abused while under anaesthesia or waking up from operations. There was an almost equal number of boys and girls. And less than half of the British public supports junior doctors going on strike. The BMA has begun balloting the medics, now known as resident doctors, for strike action that could last for 6 months. The union's leaders say they want the equivalent of a 29% pay rise. But a survey by YouGov suggests only 39% of British adults support more hospital walkouts. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
This is the sound of a forehand shot. And this is the sound of a backhand shot. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious. Like choosing Interactive Investor for your personal pension. As a Which-recommended SIP provider, with a low flat fee, and a wide choice of investment options, the choice is obvious.
Advantage Wendy!
Woo-hoo! Search Interactive Investor Personal Pension. SIP values can fluctuate, and you could get back less than you invest.
Today's another busy one in the Thing household. Mum's mowing the lawn, Dad's cooking tea, Ash is upstairs spinning tunes, and the twins are on a mission. Luckily, the Things are beating the price cap with a cheaper fixed tariff from British Gas. So, the twins can keep making sure the galaxy stays safe. Search British Gas tariffs. British Gas, taking care of things. Eligibility and T's and C's apply. To verify, visit britishgas.co.uk/verify.
Whoa! Look! Is that Dragonite? Dragon-type Pokemon have arrived. Discover in Happy Meal now. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until 17th of June from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy. Pokemon range comprises toys only while stocks last.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 p.m. with Daryl Morris.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can harness the power of solar at hivehome.com.
A fantastic sign-off from one of our regular listeners this afternoon, describing himself as low-value handyman. You're absolutely not. Unfortunately, a big impact on birds like swifts is the reduction in the insect population caused by urbanisation, pesticides, intensive farming, etc., etc. So if you are going to use a swift box or brick, it's a good idea to plant a wildflower meadow or make sure there are lots of flowers in your garden. A great advantage of swifts is that they eat wasps. I'm on a learning curve there. Yeah, I never knew that.
I didn't think anything ate wasps.
No, but you're absolutely right to point out that a wildflower meadow would be a good thing.
Yes, not everyone can do that. Yeah.
No, but the £25 brick hopefully is. Violent attacks targeting crypto investors and executives are on the rise, with a wave of cases reported in France and the US in recent weeks. Most recently, an Italian tourist was allegedly kidnapped, tortured and held at gunpoint in a townhouse in Manhattan after failing to hand over his password for his crypto funds. Now, it follows a series of violent attacks that have seen crypto investors and their families abducted or assaulted by criminals who are targeting their digital finances. Angus Berwick is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal who's been writing about these attacks, and he's in the studio with us now. Angus, explain what we're seeing with these attacks. I mean, unfortunately, very wealthy people can be targeted all of the time. What's really different about this?
I mean, what's driving this is, you know, the price of Bitcoin, along with, you know, a whole sway of other cryptocurrencies, you know, has really kind of exploded over the last 6 months. I mean, you know, one Bitcoin is now worth like almost $110,000. You know, criminals are obviously kind of, you know, are very aware of this, that many people are sitting on these absolute kind of you know, gold mines of tokens. And are kind of actively kind of seeking out, you know, vulnerable targets who they think, you know, they can, you know, extort them for their passwords, you know, kidnap their relatives, try to gain access to, for instance, like a hard drive on which they actually hold the cryptocurrencies. And we're seeing these cases kind of pop up. Yeah, kind of all across the globe at the moment.
Now, forgive my ignorance about cryptocurrency, because I don't own any. Once you've nicked somebody's cryptocurrency and somebody's, let's just say, Bitcoin, would it not be quite easy to trace who the new owner was and therefore find the criminal? Or is that the advantage, that you really can't do that?
You can do it. I mean, you know, cryptocurrency, when you move it across the, you know, these kind of blockchain ledgers, you know, typically, I mean, those are public and you can kind of follow the cryptocurrency as it moves from one, you know, digital wallet to another. But the problem with crypto is that these transactions can move so, you know, so quickly, you know, much faster, for instance, than a bank transfer, that you can kind of start to lose the trail, you know, particularly if the cryptocurrency gets, you know, pinged through like an offshore exchange or a mixer. It can become, you know, very complicated and kind of beyond the, you know, what a regular person might have access to.
So it is going to be easier to dispose of your criminal goods than, let's say, if you'd nick some gold bullion or you're trying to flog a necklace or some of the more old school traditional methods of thieving.
Most likely. You know, crypto, you can move huge amount of crypto, you know, very quickly. And you could then convert it into, you know, like a regular currency in some other kind of distant part, kind of corner of the world.
Is one of the problems here that quite a few of these very, very wealthy individuals are also, I don't want to say bragging about their wealth, because nobody deserves to be targeted, you know, in a vicious and mean assault or kidnapping. But if you are saying, look at me on my amazing yacht, look at me in my amazing duplex penthouse, are you advertising literally where you are and how much money you might have, and you're making it slightly easier to become a target?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think that is part of it. Within some of the cases that we've looked at, you know, there was one victim who was, yeah, you know, very kind of openly bragging about his winnings and, you know, how he was spending them on his social media. You know, and I think criminals nowadays are very adept at not only looking at your social media, but perhaps your, you know, your families and your friends, to kind of pinpoint your location and your home. And I think, you know, with people I've been speaking to in the industry, I think that they're now kind of, taking steps to kind of limit the amount of information they're putting out in public. You know, they're turning their Instagram private and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Are only a certain number of gangs behind all of these recent assaults, or is it just not possible to know that yet?
Yeah, I think it's probably still a bit early to kind of know how coordinated this all is, at least in France, where, you know, there have been at least kind of three or four, you know, different kind of kidnapping attempts. I think, you know, authorities there, and, you know, based on our reporting, have said that that it does appear that some of these cases are being kind of coordinated by, you know, by one group.
And do you think there's any evidence that they might be state-sponsored?
In France, I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any evidence of that.
Another power move by Putin to start setting up crypto kidnappers.
That would definitely could be a good potential new kind of source of revenue. You know, I think there is some history for that. You know, for instance, the North Korean state, you know, for a long time there's a hacking kind of state-sponsored hacking group there called the Lazarus Group, which for years has been kind of pillaging crypto from, you know, big crypto platforms. But yeah, who knows? That could be, you know, where this is heading.
And in exactly the same way that in an attempt to stop bike theft in major cities, the police offer you the opportunity to brand your bike or have invisible liquid numbers painted on it and stuff like that. Is there something that the cryptocurrency platforms would be able to do to just make it harder for people to dispose of illegally gained cryptocurrency?
Well, because in a way, you know, I mean, what we're seeing is, you know, in the past, the way that you would most, you know, usually lose your crypto would be because the platform itself where you store your crypto kind of gets hacked, you know, for instance, by like the Lazarus Group. A lot of these platforms, they've really invested a lot into their cybersecurity. So what criminals are now doing is that instead of trying to, you know, break into the platform itself, they're just going directly, you know, to the victim, and then, you know, using kind of violent means, you know, getting kind of threatening them in order to get their password or to get, you know, their hard drive. In a way, the platform's efforts to make kind of customers' crypto more secure has actually kind of sparked this new crime wave.
And just how violent have some of these assaults and abductions been?
You know, I think in two of the French cases we've looked at, the kidnappers lopped off a finger of the victim in order to try to convince their associates to pay the ransom. In this kind of very recent case that is just now kind of moving through the courts in the US, I think one of the alleged kidnappers used a chainsaw to kind of menace the victim into handing over his password.
Right. So very violent.
Pretty violent.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating stuff. It's sinister stuff.
It's kind of, we are increasingly understanding the kind of virtual fraud that's going on and the scale of the cost of the UK economy, aren't we? But this is just something completely different when it spills over into this horrible physical attacks.
Yeah. Good work journalistically, Angus. Thank you very much indeed for telling us about it. That's Angus Berwick, who is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. That takes us to exactly 3:15.
We've all been told we must keep checking out ChatGPT using AI tools, but what is the true environmental impact? We're going to speak to an energy expert and an entrepreneur coming up next. So it's 2:45. This is Fee Glover and Marthalene Fox on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to solar simple and easy at hivehome.com.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon, your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Hello, you've caught me at the hairdresser's, brushing up on the best business advice with my friend Deborah Meaden.
Well, Einstein, staying on top of your numbers is crucial.
Indeed, and a smart meter can help you track your energy use and costs over time, so you can trim and adjust where needed.
Meaning more control of your business budgeting.
Now that's sharp.
Search Get a Smart Meter for Business today. Eligibility may vary. Consumer action required.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all 7 continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and and best luxury ocean cruise operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
To mix a perfect mojito this summer, all you need is some ice, some rum, and then top up with zesty, refreshing Fever Tree Mojito Mixer. Finish with a splash of sunshine and some good friends and enjoy. Mmm, maybe you don't need the sunshine. Fever Tree Mojito Mixer. Mix with the best. Please enjoy responsibly.
Jen had a great idea. Jen set up a new company. Jen was excited. Jen knew she needed insurance, but she couldn't find the right package to suit her needs. And that's when the penny dropped. Jen got in contact with her Bieber insurance broker, Ben. Ben gave helpful advice and found competitive rates from a choice of insurers that would cover her needs. Every business owner needs a Ben. To find yours, call 0800 999 775 or go to benthebroker.co.uk today.
This is Times Radio.
Heba Bevan is a rare phenomenon. She's an electronics engineer and an entrepreneur who is also an expert on energy and AI. After studying engineering at Cambridge, she spun out her tech company from the university and she's won multiple awards and accolades. So we're thrilled to have her here today to talk about something that I don't think we hear enough about, the environmental impact of all these new ways that we're using technology and specifically AI. Heba, welcome. It's lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate meeting you again. And thanks for the introduction.
Heba, tell us what the impact on energy consumption AI is having, because I think a lot of people listening won't have thought about it very much. And why should they have done?
Well, we have basically environmental crisis right now, an energy crisis, because for decades, we don't have enough energy and it's very expensive. And looking at AI, UK has been always at really cutting edge and front in terms of delivering the best algorithms, delivering the mathematical and the science behind it. And right now we are losing that battle because of energy. So AI uses a huge amount of energy. So if you could actually imagine when you are doing a search, a normal search could be where is the shop to shop for, I don't know, copybox or glasses or whatever. So any search you do on the internet today is actually lighting a bulb, a light bulb. You are lighting that light bulb. With the current situation, what we have and the technology enable us, we can actually search not just where can I get my glasses and where what the shop next to me would do or about my area or the best school in this area. It becomes more, can you write my essay? Can you do this for me? Can you summarize this book? So when we use the current, any ChatGPT or any actually a platform that delivers a huge amount of AI, we're lighting a whole entire building, not just one light bulb. So it's a whole entire building.
So just to be super clear and make sure we're understanding that correctly, when you're doing like a quick, let's say, Google search to look at what the weather might be tomorrow, that's a light bulb in equivalent terms of energy. But when you're going on to ChatGPT to say, write me a love poem for Fee because it's been so wonderful sitting alongside her this last few days, that is lighting a whole building.
Yes, yeah. It's really a huge amount of power. And if you could see how much our energy costs us in the UK and the cost of energy, it's really bringing another kind of hurdle for a progressing AI in a country. Because if we want to have certain models and certain algorithms and we want to use that models in the UK, it's very expensive because that will basically you need a way to get that energy. And we know UK, we buy most of our energy currently, which is it's sad, but it's true.
So you work obviously saw this situation and appreciated that it's massively under kind of invested in and thought about and invented Utterbury. Can you tell us what Utterbury is and how does it help the problem?
Well, so Utterbury, we do a lot of AI. And we've been doing it from day one. So we are a 12 years old business. We spun out of Cambridge University back in 2013. And the way we do AI and we actually use the algorithm is used at the cutting, at the kind of the node, at the literally the heart of the device. Instead of processing these data on the cloud, and storing it somewhere. So what is essentially what we do, we take these data, we throw the kind of what we call rubbish data, and what it's unique of certain data, and what we call it peaks or neuromorphic kind of data. That data is being captured, processed on board, on the sensor, and fed to the system. So if you could imagine today, you take huge amount of pictures, could be for your son, for your daughter, for a cat, a dog, a flower, a garden, and we save these pictures. But that pictures doesn't sit on one device. It sits usually, you have a cloud account, and it's in the cloud, which is a big warehouse for data, and it uses a lot of storage, which is a lot of as well. It needs a huge amount of cooling, a huge amount of electricity to keep all that data. But you end up using the data. You store it in your phone. You store it in your computer. And when you don't have enough storage, even in your phone, what are you going to do? You get another phone, you download the same things in it. So you've got another device having exactly the same data. So here what we do is basically process data that is meaningful on the chip and saving the information, the essence. So in a simple term, if I can say to someone 1 + 1 = 2, we don't need to save the 1 + 1. But if it's 2, it's actually the information that we need to have, that the 2 is being processed and is given to us.
I think that the technical details might be starting to lose some of us, but I understand that you're basically reducing dramatically the energy cost that's needed to do the same kind of tasks. And you're doing it mainly across infrastructure projects. I think a lot of what's interesting about the challenges for AI over the next decade are probably about how we're going to build big projects, whether it's our water systems or our new roads or some of the other things that we're having to do to get growth going in the country. And you've been working a lot, haven't you, with infrastructure projects. But I guess I'm interested, Heba, what can us, though, as individuals do? Should we be stopping using this technology? What's the right thing to do if we have a concern?
I think stopping, it's not going to benefit anyone. We need to be current. We need to find different solutions for the problem. I think it needs to be a different type of processing. Currently, when we use ChatGPT or we use any kind of platform for AI, the storage and the energy is being done outside the UK. I don't know what is the rules and regulation and what is going to come in. And we are seeing these platforms started free. Now they introduced the cost. And in my view, that cost is going to get higher and higher and higher. And it's...
So we should be making much more careful choices as we decide how to use technology, would you say?
Yes, I think definitely. And if you need to find a recipe for something, maybe look at books. But if you don't need to know every single, cat species and where they are from, unless you're doing a thesis on it. And I can understand if you're doing a thesis or a research would need that information.
Sometimes it's difficult, isn't it? It's like we're being asked to make a bunch of choices every day about all the things that might affect the environment, from how we travel to now how we're searching on things. And well, you're quite right, I can appreciate it must feel overwhelming to people to have to think about all these different vectors. Fia, I know this is something that you've thought about a lot. Do you think about the tech challenge when you're searching around for stuff?
I don't think about it enough. And actually, Heber, I'm really interested in your thoughts about how individuals deal with all of this. A, because I don't think most people even stop to think about the energy that they're consuming when they do a ChatGPT request or a Google search. So I think there's massive education that needs to be done there. But presumably at some point, you do have to incentivize people to use less of this stuff. And who would it be who does that? Because it's not in the interests of the tech company that, you know, is using, that you're using, or the platform you're going to. It's not in their interest to make you use it.
Or even the energy company, because that's
less. So where does that kind of force come from?
Probably people will stop using it less and less when it starts hurting their pockets. Unfortunately, this is a fact. So, and I don't see and envision these platform is going to be free for very long, because they are costing. Like if we look at OpenAI or even ChatGPT or any kind of a cluster using AI, it costs a huge amount of money. You can see them. They are burning money. They're losing massively. And they're counting my platform is going to be the gold standard that everybody uses. So here, where's what we really need to understand, the people need to see, it might be that energy not spent in the UK, but that is somewhat else. It could be saved in Asia, or it could be saved in the US or somewhere else. If you are conscious about environment, it is an environment problem, because it is 100% is an environmental problem. We are affecting environment if we are doing this in general, because we've got one world to take care of, not too many worlds to take care of. It's still the same kind of all of us are alien on Earth.
I think that you're raising something that we don't think about enough. And we've had a message in from a listener, Alex G, who says, how can I turn off the AI review when I do a Google search? I can't find a way to disable it, even though a plain search works fine, which is a really good point that you're now being pushed all the time into this default of AI. So, you know, Heber, what you do is complicated and technical and hard to explain, but we appreciate you coming to tell us about how it is impacting the environment. Thank you.
I think it's an absolute blind spot for most people, and something that we will only hear about when disastrous things start happening.
Yeah, or if people start getting charged a lot of money, as Heber says.
Yes.
If suddenly you're getting charged a lot more for all this stuff, then I think it'll become a bit more in the open, perhaps.
And a terrible incentive to just grab it all now before the paywall goes up.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And a very good afternoon from Times Towers. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Martha Lane Fox. Still to come in the next hour of the programme, will Keir Starmer meet any of his policing targets? Not if he doesn't throw some cash at the problem. That's according to 6 police chiefs writing in the Times today. We'll talk to one of them next. Should we all be working a 32-hour week? And Jesse Armstrong, creator of Succession and the rest, will join us just after 3:30. Let's get the news first with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Police have been given more time to question a man arrested after a car collided with people at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade. Police believe the vehicle which struck pedestrians on Water Street on Monday had followed an ambulance crew after a road block was temporarily lifted. Times Radio's Nick Ellerby is in the city.
This is the second extension Merseyside police have had to question a 53-year-old man from the West Derby area of Liverpool, arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and driving under the influence of drugs. He's been held since Monday evening.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Hamas chief in Gaza, Mohammed Sinwar, has been eliminated. He was one of Israel's most wanted and the younger brother of the militant group's former leader, Yahya Sinwar, who was killed in a gun battle with Israeli troops last year. Military analyst Professor Michael Clark says the timing of the Israeli announcement is interesting.
Netanyahu said 2 weeks ago, we think we've got him. Interesting to see what sort of evidence they got. Maybe they got some DNA, because that's the most important. Sometimes they can get that from agents on the ground, people who are working within the population. That's the thing that matters. But the fact that he said now is part, I think, or I'm guessing, is the political issue of saying, look, our offensive in Gaza is working. Our offensive in Gaza is important. We are doing this.
A former surgeon who admitted sexually abusing hundreds of children in France has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Joel Laskwanek, who's 74, was found guilty of raping and sexually assaulting 299 children. Most of the victims were abused while under anaesthesia or waking up from operations. There was an almost equal number of boys and girls. Less than half the British public would support another strike by junior doctors. The BMA's begun balloting the medics, now known as resident doctors, for strike action that could last for 6 months. The union's leaders say they want the equivalent of a 29% pay rise. A survey of more than 4,000 adults by YouGov found 48% opposed doctors going on strike, 39% were in favour. Former Conservative Health Minister Edwina Currie has told Times Radio she opposes any more pay rises.
Senior leaders of the junior doctors, of the resident doctors, are only interested in politics. And these guys going on strike are utterly wrong and utterly immoral and, in my view, should not get an extra penny.
The price of groceries rose 4.1% this month. Analysts say the fastest increases are in chocolate, sweets, sun care and butter. Prices are falling fastest in pet food and paper products. And the UK has had its sunniest spring since records began in 1910. That's according to provisional figures from the Met Office. 630 hours of sunshine were recorded between the beginning of March and yesterday. That beats the previous record in 2020 during the COVID lockdown by 4 hours. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive.
If you're a fan of Succession, then you'll want to stay with us until after 3:30 this afternoon, because the creator and writer Jesse Armstrong joins us. He's got a new movie out called Mountain Head, which is all about some tech bros. Actually, one of our listeners did ask us to stop using tech bros.
Yeah, I saw that.
As a term, implying that everybody knows exactly who we're talking about. So you're a tech chick? Is that
no.
even a thing?
Heaven help us. No, no,
what
no.
is the female equivalent of the tech
bro? There is
bro?
No one. That is the point.
That's the problem.
That's
okay.
the problem.
Okay. But the tech bro thing is essentially technology that, brothers.
Yes.
And yes. Brothers. As Keir Starmer said, actually, didn't he, once in the House of Commons?
Did he?
He did. Oh, he was heading towards tech bros, which had obviously been written down in front of him.
Someone was thinking abort.
And I would imagine, you know, being a very well-educated lawyer, he thought, well, I've got to elongate that. I can't have these abbreviations said on the parliamentary estate. So he did say tech brothers.
I thought he said tech fraternity or something.
You know, said something in Latin. But tech bros is bandied around.
It's just bandied around, and it means nothing more complicated than the fact that most of these companies, in fact, all of them, I can't think of a single one that isn't, are run by men. And there is a kind of network. So there's something called the PayPal Mafia. They all started at PayPal. The guy that went on to found LinkedIn, Elon Musk, David Sachs, who's now Trump's AI advisor. So there is this kind of network. And so there's this feeling that there might be this kind of bro culture, as in people hanging out and dudeing around and inventing tech businesses. It's quite hard to argue against that, in my experience.
Yeah. We will talk more about Jesse Armstrong's work as we go through the programme this afternoon. First, though, six of Britain's most senior police chiefs say that the Prime Minister can't deliver on his promises to cut crime without some new money. Writing in the Times, they're warning Keir Starmer that he'll fail to deliver on his pledges without it. The Prime Minister's promises to halve knife crime cut rates of violence against women and girls and recruit 13,000 police officers into neighbourhood policing are apparently all at risk. Chief Constable Gavin Stevens is chair of the National Police Chiefs Council and one of the six signatories. You're very welcome on the programme this afternoon, Gavin Stevens. The most important moment in decades for the government to choose to back policing. That's just one quote from the letter that you've signed. Tell us more about that. It's quite a bold statement.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for giving us the time. And for some time in UK policing, we've been advocating for really ambitious reform. We know that policing in the United Kingdom is fundamentally based on a design from a Royal Commission in the early 1960s, and that the pace of the world that we live in now is really changing the nature of crime and offending dramatically, with more than 50% of crime committed online, 80% of crime having a digital component to it somewhere. We really need to change the way that we work, and we have strong ambitions to do that. We also really welcome the government's very strong ambitions to halve violence against women and girls, to halve knife crime, to restore trust back into policing and the justice system. And to be successful in these ambitions and to drive the reforms that we needed, we really do need strong funding settlements. Over time, of course, there's a potential to get great benefit from it. We know through analysis from our chief scientific advisor, Professor Paul Taylor, that the teams that he's been working with, that money invested in policing not only is good for crime reduction effects, so for example, a 10% increase in our funding, something in the nature of 1.9 billion. Can really have not only good crime reduction effects, but can help the UK economy. So £1, for example, invested in policing leads to something like £4 on housing stock value. And of course, it makes common sense, doesn't it, that if people are safe and they feel safe, then businesses invest, shops can trade, sure. People like to live in those areas.
So it does make absolute common sense. But I suppose the thing that you're warning about is the joined up thinking behind that common sense, because quite clearly you're saying that the government is standing behind lecterns and on stages saying one thing, which is these are our glorious political aims, and all hail to them. Who wouldn't want to reduce rates of violence against women and girls? Who wouldn't want to halve knife crime? But then the people that we're expecting to do that, you, are saying that's just not possible. I mean, how not possible is it?
Well, I think we take a step back from that question just for a moment. And even if you take the ambition to have violence against women and girls, that's not a political issue, a government issue, a policing issue. It's a whole societal approach. That means all of us, whatever world or industry that we live or work in, has got to play our part in doing so. There's no way that policing can do that alone, or a government can do that alone. But policing wants to play a very active part in that challenge, in that ambition. To do that well, we need our teams to be supported with really effective technology. We have had, over the last 10 years, no capital investment in local forces. I don't mean a small amount, I mean none. So most local forces for their technology refreshes, for example, are reliant on borrowing. Of course, borrowing in the public sector stacks up debt. That reduces the amount that you've got to spend on your officers and staff, and we are a people-driven business. So if we're to get ourselves fit and ready for these challenges of today and in the future, we need a deliberate new design for policing, which we've seen colleagues in other jurisdictions around the globe do. We often talk to colleagues in other jurisdictions. They admire greatly some of what we do here, and we've got a lot to learn from what's happening elsewhere as well. And for us to be successful in the ambitions, but also for us to have a police service that's well equipped and able to deal with the threats of the future, we need strong funding settlements. So we don't enter into these sort of debates and shared editorials lightly. We're very thoughtful about it, but this is a pivotal moment, I think, for policing in the UK.
How much money are we talking about?
Well, policing at the moment is a 19 billion or so sector. So, in comparisons with other areas of government spending, relatively modest. You know, something in the region of 1 or just under 1% of government department expenditure level. We probably all say that it maybe occupies more than 1% of our attention and concerns in our day-to-day lives. So when you look at international benchmark, and my close colleague Sir Mark Rowley, Commissioner of the Met, commented on some of the international benchmarks for London earlier today. Other jurisdictions often attract more investment, and you know, we understand that these are very difficult choices for any government in any jurisdiction.
Yeah, can you give us an idea of that comparison, Gavin Stevens? I mean, when you talk about other jurisdictions, I'm presuming we can find some kind of a comparable city to, say, London and the Metropolitan Police Force. What are other countries giving that type of and that size of police force? How does it compare to what the Met is receiving here? Do you know?
Yeah, well, I know Sir Mark talked this morning about the comparison with New York, you know, a similar size city that has many thousands more officers. I guess at the other end of the spectrum, I would give the context of small local forces that are really struggling with their financial resilience. So Chief Constable of Lincolnshire, Paul Gibson, has really spoken publicly, and as his Police and Crime Commissioner, about just how they're struggling with their financial resilience in a force that resides on a much, much smaller budget. And herein lies the discussion about reform. The system of forces that we have dates back to the early 1960s. It's one that expects forces to maintain a certain level of capability and resilience. And for the threats in the world that we currently live in, it's very hard to do that now. So we are actively working with government on a very ambitious programme of reform that would see stronger national capabilities. I called it in a speech that I did to our annual conference last year, National Policing Directorate, that can provide services once for everybody on the things that where it's sensible to do that. To provide some services at the region where that's sensible. So that happens already in things like counterterrorism and serious organised crime. And to do those things locally that have to be done locally, you know, good quality neighbourhood policing, local investigations and so on. But clearly we now live in a world where we need to brigade these capabilities into more resilient arrangements to get us fit for the future. Yeah. And to make those changes, we need help with the investment to get there.
You've mentioned how rare it is for so many police chiefs to get together to put an editorial piece, which is in our newspaper today. So you've done that. Obviously, many of you have been out and about today. We've had a very reasonable conversation with you, and we're grateful for the information that you've given us. But what happens if you don't get the money? What happens if nothing is really coming back in terms of an increased budget for you? What would you then feel it was appropriate to do or say?
Well, I think the first thing to say in response to that is that our colleagues will still provide the best available service that they can 24/7, 365 a year. And as we've seen in recent days, really find themselves in the midst of all sorts of incidents, tragedies, crime investigations. So we will keep doing that, and we will keep working hard, but we will find it harder to keep pace with the way that the world is changing if we don't get the right investment. I mean, some stark statistics. If you just look, for example, at child sex abuse committed online, more than half of that is committed by teenagers with other teenagers. You know, the risks that our young people face are very stark. We're, you know, as a whole society, trying to respond to these things. And of course, in policing, we need people with the right skill sets, equipped by the right technology to be able to tackle these threats, whether it's that or whether it's some of the fraud and financial crime that we see, whether it's the spread of mis and disinformation that breeds community tensions. Without investment, we will be less effective as these things. Yeah. It doesn't mean that we won't be able to keep people safe and feeling safe. We work hard at that every day, but it will be a harder struggle, I think, to keep pace with the way the world is changing.
Just before you go, the Merseyside police disclosed the ethnicity of the man charged over the Liverpool crash. Should that be standard? Is it already standard? Is that something that has been discussed between chief constables?
Well, in a way, this is a good indicative example of the world that we now live in. So when a tragedy happens like this, very quickly online, there will be some information from people's mobile phone footages, from local CCTV cameras, which sometimes can give a partial picture of what's happened. If there's not that, rumours spread. And what happens when you get a partial picture, as we've seen, is that mis- and disinformation can take hold. And mis- and disinformation, in the absence of accuracy and transparency, can fuel even more tragedy, and none of us want to see that. So police chiefs would really welcome a framework where we're able to be more transparent sooner, but none of us want to put at risk justice. None of us would want a situation where we ever put a trial or an inquest process at risk because of the information that's been released. So this needs careful debate and sensible discussion across all involved. We made public just a couple of months ago our arguments to the Law Commission's review on contempt of court, for example, making some comparisons across other jurisdictions. So, you know, it is possible, for example, to read more information online more quickly in other jurisdictions than it is in ours, and they still have safe and secure justice systems. So I think it is possible to get the balance right. The framework that we currently have, I think, needs some adjustment to enable us to do that. I think that will help us build trust and confidence for those times, and there will always be these times where we are dealing with things where we cannot give the information for good and understandable reason. And we may even have situations where we can't even tell you why that is the case. And of course, that's difficult.
It is difficult. And actually, I think it's a subject that we will return to, because I think so many people might not understand the contempt of court rules and why it is that certain things can't immediately be said. And you're absolutely right. It makes a very, very difficult set of circumstances for police who are dealing with the direct aftermath of incidents. Thank you very much indeed. We've enjoyed hearing from you. That's Chief Constable Gavin Stevens. Theo Usherwood has been listening into that. Theo, the last thing that any government wants is a national ticking off from police forces around the country, all quite clearly saying that actually, if they don't get the money, the services will suffer, and that means our safety. So how difficult do you imagine this will get?
It's going to get very difficult, and I think it's instructive of the position that police forces now find themselves in, that any private conversations that may have taken place between the National Police Chiefs, National Office of Police Chiefs and the Treasury, they're turned out to one side, and they've decided to go public in this way 2 weeks before the spending review on June the 11th. I thought the particular line that stood out from me from that interview that you did from Gavin Stevens was that he said that he wanted businesses to feel that they could invest in safe communities. Of course, business investment translates into economic growth. This isn't just a message. This isn't a message to Keir Starmer. It isn't even a message to Yvette Cooper. The police officers already, the police chiefs already have her on side. It's a message to Rachel Reeves. Chancellor, if you want to deliver on your promise to deliver to secure economic growth and to see the GDP of this country go up and for us all to feel better off, then businesses need to feel that the communities that they're investing in, where they're setting up their shops or their factories or their offices, they're safe, and that they can and that people want to live and work there. And that argument is a powerful one. This is a message tailored to the Treasury. They know that the Home Office is not a protected department. They've seen the shortfall of 300 million, and they need to try and change that to ensure, change that trajectory where they're not going to get the money that they need to ensure that they can do the work that's necessary to deliver on that promise, not just in terms of halving violence against women and girls, halving knife crime, ensuring 13,000 extra police officers. But as the letter from the police chiefs and the security services, that's the really damaging one on the front page of the Times today, makes clear, they need to maintain control on the streets of this country, and they're not going to be able to do that if they see their funding slashed.
Theo, thank you very much indeed. That is our political correspondent, Theo Usherwood. That takes us to 20 minutes past three.
Don't forget, you can get in touch with us by email, janeandfee@times.radio, on WhatsApp 0333 00 323 53, or tweet, I'm glad we're still using tweet, not Xing, #TimesRadio. You've heard of the 4-day week. Well, is it time to do away with that as well and let people just work whenever they want? This is Fee Glover and Marthalene Fox on Times Radio, and we'll be discussing that after the break. We're sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at Hive Home, hivehome.com.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation.
Is it just me that strikes me there's a whiff of nonsense about the deal?
Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself.
Even while it drags on and as horrifying as it is, it should have been a foreign policy triumph.
Plus unique perspectives on the day's news.
There seems to be a theme here, and that is that no one knows what's going on.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Make 2025 your year of adventure in Fred Olsen Cruise Line Summer Sale. On now at Hayes Travel. You'll raise a glass to a free drinks package on selected sailings. Plus, there are special savings for solo guests too. Sail away with great savings in Fred Olsen Cruise Line Summer Sale. Book by the 25th of June in your local Hayes Travel branch. Conditions apply.
At Aberdeen Asian Income Fund, we understand Asia because we're here. For over 30 years, we've been on the ground, searching for the most compelling and high-performing companies across the Asia-Pacific region. But it's not just about capital growth. Asia offers abundant opportunities for those seeking income. Unlock Asia's potential and invest with us today. Search Aberdeen Asian Income Fund online to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
This is the call of the chiff-chaff. This is the call of the willow warbler. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious. Like choosing Interactive Investor for your ISA and personal pension. With 30 years' experience, over 430,000 customers, and a rating of excellent on Trustpilot, the choice is obvious. Search Interactive Investor. Investment values can go down as well as up. You could get back less than you invest.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to solar simple and easy at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
If you're looking for parenting advice, look no further than the new parenting newsletter. You can sign up if you're a Times subscriber. And every Friday you get a fantastic newsletter with time-saving tips, personal stories, and it covers all ages from toddlers to teens. Sign up at thetimes.com/parenting-newsletter. You might have heard of the four-day week, but shall we go a step further? How about being able to work whenever you want? A tech company in Wales has announced a three-month trial of a completely flexible 32-hour working week where employees can work anytime on any day from Monday to Sunday, anywhere they like. Fancy that? I'm not sure if I think about this, but I know somebody that does have an opinion. That's Joe Ryle. He's the director of the 4-Day Week Foundation, and he's joining us now. Hi, Joe. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good afternoon.
Joe, you've obviously championed the 4-Day Week. What are your thoughts on this new worked week, just 32 hours? Is that a step too far, positive, or how do you think about it?
I think we broadly welcome it. You know, I think it's in line with the kind of general move towards a shorter working week. You know, we've seen hundreds of companies over the last few years successfully move to a kind of 32-hour working week over 4 days. You know, most of the companies that are accredited for our network do that over 4 days. But, you know, I think we're totally open to people finding their own version of that model. You know, because this, we've had 100 years of this kind of 9-to-5, 5-day working week, and workers are desperate for more freedom, more autonomy from work. And, you know, it's not up to us to dictate exactly how people do their 4-day week, but essentially we see it as kind of a similar move to a 4-day working week and broadly welcome it.
The founder of the company in Wales that's trialling this says that the reason they're doing it is because they want to make their company as attractive as possible to new recruits and to make sure that existing staff know that they support flexible working. You know, is that the main reason that you find businesses think this kind of flexibility is important?
Yeah, I think, you know, these early kind of pioneers, these companies adopting these patterns are essentially embracing the future of work. You know, we've had this really old and outdated working pattern for a long time. And, you know, it's not working for workers. It's often not working for companies as well, who have low productivity. And so, as we found, when companies move to a 4-day working week, you know, their workers are more refreshed. refreshed, they're better rested, they're more motivated. That brings benefits to both the employer and to the employee. And, you know, I think it's a long time overdue, these changes to the workplace. And, you know, we really welcome that everyone's trying different ways of working, whether it's 9-day fortnights, 4-day weeks, flexible working. It feels like, it's a change which is not going to go away, and hopefully we'll start to become a more normal way of working.
But isn't one of the main problems with this whole debate that it really is just a privilege for some people and not for others? I totally understand it, you know, as a not very good entrepreneur myself and a person that has a flexible working life, that for me and that people who are in a lucky position, being able to choose when you work and where you work, and you might have an office in your home and all of that kind of stuff. But for most people, you have to go somewhere. You might have to clock into a factory or a warehouse, or you might have to clock into a different kind of work. And aren't we just really constantly tilting and worrying about the people that have a privileged work position?
I mean, there's certainly going to be different challenges to implementing a 4-day week in different sectors. But, you know, we've worked with all the pilots we've run over the last few years and one local council. We've worked with companies across manufacturing, retail, hospitality. You know, there's the first council that moved to a 4-day working week, and all the bin refuse workers have also moved to a 4-day week. So these are in sectors where people say will be more challenging. But actually, you know, they have found that it has been possible. And it may, you know, implementation may look different. It may take a bit longer in some sectors. But there's no excuse for no one engaging in this now. You know, this is what workers want. It's been shown to, you know, really improve job retention, job recruitment, overall better for well-being and family life. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be at least exploring this. And it just may take a bit longer to get there in some sectors, but absolutely we do think it's possible, because we've seen it's possible in various different sectors of the economy.
One of the things that you'll know well, you know, our economy has not got the most impressive productivity metrics, especially when compared with the US. And when you look at the kind of distance now between our productivity numbers and the US productivity numbers over the last decade, it's pretty startling. You know, you've mentioned that this improves productivity, but I think lots of people's assumption might be that it does the opposite. Can you just unpick that a bit more for us?
Yeah. I mean, sure. You know, I understand that, you know, it can seem counterintuitive on the face of it, that kind of working less hours would create more productivity. But we have seen that now. And there's report after report after report showing this, you know, that essentially when workers are better rested, when they're more focused on the kind of outputs they're doing in 4 days rather than five, you know, you are more efficient. You cut out that presenteeism, which is rife across the British economy. We see it in various different sectors for all the companies we meet. And if you compare across to the rest of Europe, you know, we actually work some of the longest full-time hours compared to other countries in the EU, for example, while having one of the least productive economies. So from our point of view, what that suggests is that working all these really long hours is causing burnout, overwork, mental health issues in the workplace, but not producing good results for the economy. And it does feel like we need to try something different. Time for change.
It's interesting, yesterday, Joe, we had a conversation about the 2.78 million people who are off work sick, and what an incredible complex challenge that is for the economy and for those individuals. And after that, someone got in touch with me to say that they were working in a company, and the company had said that this the policy was be offering people 4 duvet days a day, you know, and you can just say you're going to stay at home for no particular reason. And what they found when they did that was that the productivity went massively up. People didn't actually take as many days off sick, and surprise, surprise, they didn't use all of the duvet days anyway. It's interesting, isn't it, how the psychology of this sometimes is what is perhaps the most positive thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that is what's been missing from this conversation. You know, if we want to get people that are long-term sick back into work, then we've got to be talking about making work more attractive. You know, it can't be punishing people and cutting their benefits. You know, we've got to make work more attractive so people want to work, make it more rewarding. And, you know, that is, you know, people desperately do want a better work-life balance. It's not good balance to only have 2 days a week for the rest of your life. And what we're saying, you know, it's not that radical, just saying we want 1 day extra. All the productivity gains we've had in the economy for the last few decades, you know, you think about AI as well coming in, these make us more productive. And so workers should benefit, and that will make the workplace better, healthier, people be more refreshed. And I think would massively contribute towards bringing some of those long-term sick back into the workplace.
Joe Ryle, Director of the 4-Day Week Foundation, thank you for helping us understand the complexities of a 4-Day Week.
And thank you for all of your messages this afternoon. Dale says, if you were talking about introducing a 4-day working week for council workers, I spot a problem. Most will never have worked solidly for 4 days a week. Yes, I am one of the millions of self-employed business owners who deliver real productivity. And another who chooses to remain anonymous says, give me strength. No wonder the rest of the world is doing better than us.
I have to say, as a I find myself conflicted about this because I don't think I've ever managed to achieve work-life balance. And there is something about just making sure that people know that it is also pretty important for an economy to have lots of entrepreneurs with grit, working hard and all of this important stuff that helps innovation and growth. It doesn't just happen by random chance.
Yeah. And we had a little chat about it in the office before coming on air, didn't we? And I think I think there's quite a lot to be said for knowing when it is that you're expected to go to work. I think it is an absolute privilege of the creative industries to imagine that work can be all over the shop. It can be at work at weekends or in the middle of the night or whatever it is. But actually, I think for an awful lot of people, it is helpful to just say, you go to work, you do a certain number of hours a week. Sometimes that does feel quite tough, but that's just what we all do. It's helpful for young people to be able to navigate the working world in a way that is just simple. So I don't think I'm an enormous fan of the...
We're seeming very old right now. For you.
Wafted all over the place.
If we were 20 years old, I think they'd be looking, oh, for goodness sake, you two.
Oh, well, I mean, that's just a given, isn't it? That's a total given. Coming up, Succession creator Jesse Armstrong on his new film, which is called Mountain Head. It's just gone 3:30. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Pete. Good afternoon. Police have been given more time to question a 53-year-old man arrested after a car collided with people at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade. The suspect's being held on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. Officers believe the vehicle which struck pedestrians on Water Street on Monday had followed an ambulance after a roadblock was temporarily lifted. Two police officers who pepper sprayed and tasered a 92-year-old disabled man have been cleared of assault. PC Stephen Smith and PC Rachel Komoto went on trial over the incident involving Donald Burgess, a single leg amputee, at a care home in East Sussex in June 2022. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Hamas chief in Gaza, Mohammed Sinwar, has been eliminated. He was one of Israel's most wanted and the younger brother of former Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who was killed in a gun battle with Israeli troops last year. And senior security service bosses are warning that releasing prisoners early could pose a danger to the public. The Times has seen a letter from the heads of MI5, Scotland Yard and the National Crime Agency urging caution over letting offenders out of jail to ease overcrowding. Bosses at six police forces say they will face added pressures, but the Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner insists strict measures are in place to protect the public.
If people are well behaved and deemed not a risk, that they could be tagged and supported in the community. So it's not soft crime, it's about making sure we build the prisons we need, we've got the bobbies on the beat, and we're making sure that people are safe in their communities.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Is call handling causing a headache for your business? Moneypenny has the answer. Moneypenny's telephone answering service blends brilliant people and AI technology to create the ultimate business PA, saving you time, money and hassle. Your business and your customers deserve the UK's best service. Unrivaled telephone answering from Moneypenny. Find out more at moneypenny.com.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
This is the sound of a forehand shot. And this is the sound of a backhand shot. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious. Like choosing Interactive Investor for your personal pension. As a Which-recommended SIP provider, with a low flat fee, and a wide choice of investment options, the choice is obvious.
Advantage Wendy!
Woo-hoo! Search Interactive Investor Personal Pension. SIP values can fluctuate, and you could get back less than you invest.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
Do you know what, I'm just going to do this fantastic text from Susan. And as I was speaking, I was thinking, yeah, it's only a matter of time and you've got there. Working hours, bit rich when most TV and radio presenters and MPs work term time only. It's not even the term time only, Susan. It is our working hours. We're on air from 2 till 4, although there is quite a bit of preparation that goes into the show and books to read and all of that kind of stuff. You're absolutely right. It's not a proper job. And I'd just like to be able to put both hands up and admit that this afternoon. Thank you, Fair Cop Gov. Please continue.
Jesse Armstrong is the award-winning screenwriter behind some of your favourite shows. Succession, Peep Show, The Thick of It, Fresh Meat, what a selection. And now he's turned his attention to the billionaire tech bros, who I hope we've now clarified exactly what that means. His new film, Mountainhead, is a satirical comedy centred around four tycoons gathered in an uber-swanky mountaintop lodge in Utah for a poker weekend, as the world descends into political and economic chaos around them. Set in a world where social media has overtaken journalism and run amok, it asks the not-so-far-fetched question of what if the likes of Musk and Zuckerberg really did rule the world? I was lucky enough to speak to Jesse earlier and started by asking what fascinates him about this intersection of wealth and human behaviour.
Yeah, I guess it's just the power. You know, that was what I was interested in Succession, was media power, older media power. And this, the money for me, I think, is subsidiary in terms of the interest. That's just the setting. It's the power that these people have. And, you know, in Succession, it was old media power. And in this, it's tech power.
And is this because you think that right now this power is completely out of control? I know you made the film, I think, in record time, and it has a real sense of urgency through it. Is that because you think the situation is urgent?
Well, no, not in the sense that the film will do anything. I don't suppose will do anything impact like the development of how tech is in the world. It just felt very present to me, and like as a creative impulse, I wanted the audience who watched it to be in a similar sort of time bubble as I was when I was writing it. Because even though I think the significance of tech is going to be around evidently for the rest of our lives, this particular moment, I don't know how it will feel in another year. Maybe we're going to live in a churning, developing feeling of imminent crisis forever. That might be the way we're destined to live our lives, but it might change. And so I think I wanted to be in the same mind space as the audience might be.
So that's interesting that you don't necessarily think that you're trying to impact action, if I'm understanding you. But I watched it differently. It felt to me as though it was trying to say, look what's happening. And even though it's a character study. You've got these four tech billionaires. One is not a billionaire, much to his chagrin. You've got them trapped in the mountain retreat, and the world is collapsing around them as a new piece of software has been released that one of them has developed. It felt to me like you were saying, look, guys, this is kind of what's happening. And even worse, these are the characters as I see them.
Yeah, I think that's true. I guess I've been involved with satirical work before, from The Thick of It to Succession itself, and I know that if you think you're going to impact the world very directly, or that you are going to make people think about things the same way that you do, that's not a good creative aim to begin with, and B, you'll definitely be unsuccessful, because guess what, people are weird, various, and delightfully take completely different things from the work that you do than that which you might have expected. So I just mean that if you go into the world of like writing things about the real world, or what you might call satire, with the aim of affecting the world, there's not a much of a quicker route to disappointment.
So it's more of a character interest, is it, for you? Do you think that the tech broglicopy, or whatever the latest of way of categorizing them is, do you think that they have a certain set of characteristics that fascinate you?
Yes. They've got a tone of voice. I think it was the tone of voice that attracted me, that made it sort of something I couldn't not write. I'd got to know about, I'd read a bunch about the tech world, and then I started listening to the, you know, TED Talks and podcasts, which are a bit of a rolling carousel of where a lot of tech figures appear, famous and less famous. And there's a, you know, there's some tremendously bitter personal rivalries and multiple different ways of seeing the world. But there's a quite a similar tone of voice, which maybe just comes out of their success, which is undeniable, and power, which is undeniable. But it is a bit scary and also quite funny. And so I guess that was,
I would agree with you. I think I should reveal my conflict of interest at this point, Jesse. I was on the board of Twitter for a very long time, particularly over the last kind of 3 years when we were selling it to Elon. So I feel like I was watching this through the lens of having a small understanding of some of this world, not a world I am in. And I particularly related to how much I believe these guys really think they could redesign anything better. Countries, no problem. Somebody in your drama takes on Argentina with kind of remarkable kind of nonchalance to redesign Argentina. And that's something I really related to, this notion that everything could be reduced to ones and noughts and redesigned through the lens of technology. Is that something that you kind of discovered in your journey through the podcast and the TED Talks?
Yeah, and obviously I was aware of your hinterland in this world, and so I don't want to turn it into a reverse interview, but I'm obviously very intrigued by you, what you made of it, and how you think it maps on to the characters who you know, and certainly even the ones you don't know personally are aware of. But I think that, you know, there's a tone of, as you will know, you need confidence in to be successful in all business and tech business, and confidence at a certain point along its line of balance turns into arrogance, and that's also quite scary and quite funny, and that's the tone of voice maybe I was tuning into.
Well, I think it's bang on, and I would say it then quickly turns to hubris after that, of course. I will just give you a couple of anecdotes because you might enjoy them. The Twitter board meetings would basically happen standing up because Jack Dorsey did not like sitting down, the founder of Twitter. And, you know, normally you might have a business lunch with people and get to know your fellow board directors. No, not for Jack, because he only eats one meal a day. So he would just stand drinking a really unappealing looking green juice while we would be having a, you know, trying to have a normal bit of social interaction. I'm being slightly mean. And don't even start me on Elon. We have to have a separate side chat about that, I think, Jesse.
Okay, good. Well, I'm very much up for that.
Fantastic. I think what I really admire about your writing is that you move so incredibly quickly between biting comedy and then something that literally makes you want to scream or cry. Have you always enjoyed that? That kind of shift between the ability to make something very funny and then move it so quickly into something pretty dark?
Yeah, I mean, you can post rationalize sort of what you do and how you do it. I just don't know. That's how I write, and that's how I guess it's how I see the world or how it comes out in writing. But I do think, you know, just even as you essay very briefly, you know, a couple of visions of the tech world. Usually, in my experience in life, like tragedy, there's usually humor, either has just been in the room right before or will enter quickly after the tragedy, right? And if you can see them both, I just think it gives you a better sense of the world and the kind of, one is James Bond, right, where these people are villains and sort of omnipotent until they get taken down by our savior. I don't believe in that, nor do I believe entirely in sort of, you know, Austin Powers villain who's utterly ludicrous. I think the scary thing is these people are both, they're a bit ludicrous and a bit unbelievably powerful.
Do you think that the tech world is something you're going to double click on, to use their language, and write more about? You've kind of, the media world, clearly that's declining, being eaten by the technology world. Where next?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, you know, this is in some ways a narrower piece with a sort of more defined target, and I was pleased to write about it partly because it is so present. You know, the fears and anxieties are so present in lots of our heads that it was nice to have some way of exorcising them. I don't know if I've got a ton more to say about these that these people, so I would right now, I wouldn't anticipate returning, but I'd never say never, because you never know. And will this world continue to be dominant in our lives? Yes. And I am interested in like the forces that shape the way that most people experience the world. So maybe I will find myself coming back to it.
Have you been following much of the copyright, AI copyright discussions that have been going on in the UK?
Not closely. I'm aware of the debate, and I'm fascinated to. But have you got a view?
No, I'm just interested in whether or not you feel it very kind of hyper kind of red alert in your business, in your industry, or if it's something you personally feel hyper anxious about.
I feel for some subsequent generations of writers, I feel, you know, it will be more pressing in those terms. Yeah, I have a bit of a sort of prideful. Potential anger about one's stuff being used to train the large language models. The bolt that horse has bolted, it would obviously, given the one thing we know about the large language models and AI, is they could probably untangle that mess and send some residual checks to all the peoples whose work they've stolen to train their models. I don't suppose that will be high on their agenda for the processing power of the data centers, but it might be nice.
I think it would be extremely surprising if they sent a check, Jesse. I can imagine them sending you a piece of cryptocurrency or perhaps a stable coin, but I think a check, you might be waiting a super long time for that one.
As long as it isn't a meme coin, all the rest will be accepted.
I'm going to take Trump coin. Don't fancy that.
I'll take it for the next 2.5 years.
You are a fantastic example of kind of British soft power, I would argue. You've had this stellar career in the UK and then translated it across the Atlantic, which is no mean feat. Where do you like working the most?
That's a great question. I like being near home.
Where is home?
Emily, so I prefer to be in the UK. Having said that, I did... There is something, I've worked a lot in the US now, and there is something a little bit cleansing about, like, okay, I go to America and then I go to work, and being, when you must have had this in business as well, being totally immersed in something, like these tech guys are mostly guys, as you know, there is something that's quite good about total focus, but it's not a way to live your life, is it?
No, do you? Because the thing that often, I'm sure, as you know, gets said about the tech sector here is that it's just sort of somewhat less risk-taking, that there's just not the same appetite and ambition. I have mixed views about that. I think it's complicated. Do you perceive the same in your own industry? Is that something you could say would be true, or do you think?
No, I don't think it is. And, nowhere seems to be able to do tech like America, do they? And I'm sure you've got much better sense of precisely the different factors that lead into that. I'd say that the luckily, our creative and certainly drama and comedy are vibrant enough at this moment still for us to do, you know, as we've seen, like I've just been watching, catching up with stuff I've missed while I've been away, Adolescence and Jeff Pope's Jean-Charles de Menez's Suspect. You know, we're still writing and doing, those are both pretty serious dramas, but in comedy and drama, we can do formally interesting stuff and amongst the best stuff in the world. Yeah. And, eventually if we chip away at theatre and the BBC and Channel 4, we may eventually manage to screw that up. But those are pretty good breeding grounds for talent still in this country at the moment.
Well, that's an important message. Just one last question for me, if I can. So yeah. I can helicopter you in to Mountain Head to be with those four men for 24 hours. Lord. Would you take it? Would you take the pill? Red or
oh, my God, I'd get... Well, I'd be equally as socially awkward as them, but I wouldn't know what to say.
I'll come with you. How about that? I'll come with you.
Oh, if you'd come with me, I would definitely go for the material, and we'd both come away with rich notebooks, no doubt.
Dahlia, traumatised but full of content.
Well, that's how we often are here, traumatised and full of content. What a fantastically talented man. God, the amount of things that he's done that have really, punched through our cultural horizon. That's just incredible,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's
easy to forget that he was the kind of engineer of Peep Show, which is such a big cultural moment, wasn't it? And such a different way of thinking about television and viewers' relationship with TV. But he's also just incredibly humble and interested in understanding universes, which I think is an appealing thing.
Yes. So you'd recommend the movie?
I would recommend the movie. But prepare, don't come away with a spring in your step, I think is how I would mentally prepare for
it. Is it one bag of popcorn or you need more to sustain?
I think I would be taking in a couple, well, I know for you, a couple of Diet Cokes, a bag of popcorn, maybe an energy bar, and something uplifting to read at the end of it.
Okay. It's Jane and Fee at times.radio, 0333 003 2353. Coming up, your flying taxi is outside. Fancy taking to the skies? We will talk about that. It's one of our tech news stories with Chris Stokel-Walker. This is Fee Glover and Martha Lane Fox on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to solar simple and easy at hivehome.com.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast. Tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide. A good way to bank. Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
We don't have enough staff to clean a whole office block, I'm afraid.
Meg's new cleaning firm has been turning down some big jobs. To ensure it doesn't happen again, she needs to get her hiring done and dusted.
But I'm hoping we can be of service very soon.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
This is Times Radio.
Everything's computer.
It certainly is, Donald. Claire, we are talking about Mountainheads. That is the movie. It's been, is he kind of, would you call it the showrunner? Is he the director, writer and everything of it?
I think
it?
It's the director, writer, everything of
yeah.
it.
By Jesse Armstrong, who brought us Succession and The Thick of It and Peep Show and all of those kind of things. Mountainhead is about some tech bros hold up looking at the future of the world. It's available in cinemas now. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's the first British flying taxi. It's taken to the skies over the Cotswolds. Resident tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker joins us to talk about this development. How big is it and who can go in it, Chris? And hello.
Hello. Yeah, it's pretty big. It looks, I guess, like an old-fashioned biplane. It can hold up to 4 passengers as and when it does work, and it can travel for around about 100 miles at about 150 miles an hour. So this is a company called Vertical Aerospace. They have been trying to do this for around about a year or more. They have done test flights previously, but not had an actually piloted one. And they managed to do so in the last few days, where they managed to get over the Cotswolds with the goal of having sort of passenger-bearing flights in the next few years. Now, I will say, you know, pigs might fly, drones probably will, but I'm pretty certain that there's a very keen timeline to try and reach in just 3 years.
Right. Just the way that we're talking about this doesn't fill me with hope. It managed to get over the Cotswolds. I mean, it's just not a great tagline for an airplane, is it?
No, I mean, it was much smoother than that. But I do think that, you know, this was a prototype demonstration idea of what could come in the future, but perhaps not necessarily realistic. The company themselves say that they hope that this particular model, which they call the VX4, I think that means that there's 1, 2 and 3 before it as well, could take people from sort of Heathrow to Battersea within around about 12 minutes. So I think the idea really is this is kind of replacing helicopters, but in a less intrusive way. Worth pointing out also, the Civil Aviation Authority, the CAA, which oversees a lot of our airspace, was involved in this, and they do seem to be on board with it. So that is a tick in the sort of positive box here.
Right. I mean, that is an exciting development, so we will follow it with interest. The EU is investigating Pornhub and 3 other similar sites that it believes may have fallen foul of its online safeguard laws. What's triggered the investigation, Chris?
The ability, basically, for young people who are not meant to be on that website getting access to it. So one of the big conundrums that we always have with the internet is children basically, you know, foregoing age checks on various websites and accessing stuff that they're not meant to. These companies, these websites have been alleged to have not put in enough foresight to try and stop these people from accessing it. Basically what they do is they just put up a pop-up box saying, are you over 18? If so, click this box. And frankly, you could be under 18, you could be 65, you could be 102, and you could still click it. So that is not enough, the EU says. They are investigating it. They will be slapping them with fines if they do not follow. The whole point here is proportionality and appropriateness of the measures that they put in, because obviously we don't want underage people accessing content they shouldn't. The EU really getting quite interventionist on this, and I imagine probably also being backed by the UK as well.
Do you think it is only money that will actually change the way that these companies are acting?
Yeah, I think it's money and also personal liability. One of the things that we are starting to see is the threat of regulators saying, well, if you won't as a company take action, then we will start to single out some of your directors and actually hold you liable for that. So yeah, the fact is these companies, you know, not just the companies in terms of the adult content, but also big tech companies more generally, they make money hand over fist here. And so small fines, even in the millions, won't necessarily bring them to heel. I think it's the fear of perhaps being slapped in handcuffs and spending some time in a jail cell, that may well do so.
I've left a pretty meaty story to our last minute and a half, Chris. The seven-week Meta antitrust trial has come to the end and the company's future now lies with the judge. How long will the ruling take? What might happen?
Yeah, we are expecting this to be a little bit of time yet. So I think the thing that is notable is that this has stopped for the time being. The judge in the case is now going to kind of sit and decide what happens. We're not expecting any rulings until later this year and probably the back half of the year. Certainly, whatever way it goes, I think either side will appeal. This was the Federal Trade Commission in the United States basically saying that Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp and others, were acting in an anti-competitive way, buying out their competitors and basically snubbing out any sort of competition. What's interesting is the legal scholars that have been following this case over the last couple of months do say this is pretty close to a 50-50 case in their judgment. They think that actually there could be a real option here of the judge saying, you know what, Meta, you have overreached, you have done too much, you do need to be broken up a little bit. And so that could have huge ramifications, not just for Meta, the company, but also for all of us who use it. Remember, almost 4 billion of us across the Meta family of apps. So affects all of us almost.
4 billion, blimey. Thank you very much. It's always lovely to talk to you, Chris Stokel-Walker, our favourite tech journalist. That concludes our business for today. Martha, it's been a really lovely couple of shows. Will you come back?
Yes, please, if the listeners will have me. Thank you so much for being so kind and generous.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Gosh, we've gone terribly civilised.
I know, aren't we nice?
Aren't we lovely? Our team today, Rob, Eve, Felix and Rosie, and very much keeping us on air at all times, Ryan Boyden. I'm back tomorrow and Tom Whipple will be sitting in the vending machine of talent hot chair, so we'll look forward to that. Have a great evening when you get to it. John Pienaar is next.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Martha. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Police have been given more time to question a 53-year-old man arrested after a car hit crowds in Liverpool. And polling from the pollster YouGov finds less than half of the British public would support another strike by resident doctors. And coming up, resident doctors of the BMA, they're balloting on strike action again. But what is the public mood on the possibility of another walkout? We'll look closely. Germany and Ukraine agree to develop long-range missiles together. A correspondent in Berlin will tell us what it means for the war. And a woman who's represented America on the world stage under several administrations, including that of President Biden, gives us her thoughts on the state of play in the United States with Trump back in the White House.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Police have been given more time to question a man arrested after a car collided with people at Liverpool Football Club's title-winning parade. Officers believe the vehicle, which struck pedestrians on Water Street on Monday, had followed an ambulance crew after a roadblock was temporarily lifted. Times Radio's Nick Ellaby is in the city.
Police are still questioning a 53-year-old man arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and driving under the influence of drugs. We now know at least 79 people were injured when a car ploughed into Liverpool fans at their Premier League trophy parade at 6 p.m. on Monday. Seven people are still in hospital. Questions remain as to how the driver was able to get past a road barrier.
Two police officers who pepper-sprayed and tasered a 92-year-old disabled man have been cleared of assault. PC Stephen Smith and PC Rachel Komoto went on trial over the incident involving Donald Burgess, a single-leg amputee at a care home in East Sussex in June 2022. A former surgeon who admitted sexually abusing hundreds of children in France has been jailed for 20 years. 74-year-old Joel Lesquanec was described by prosecutors as a devil in a white coat. He was accused of 300 separate rapes and assaults in more than a dozen hospitals between 1989 and 2014. Israel's Prime Minister says the chief of Hamas in Gaza, Mohammed Sinwar, has been killed. Benjamin Netanyahu says the younger brother of the group's former leader, Yahya Sinwar, was eliminated in a strike on a hospital earlier this month.
In the last 2 days, we are making a dramatic turn towards the complete dismantling of Hamas. We are taking away their control over food distribution in the Gaza Strip. This is their money machine, and this is what dismantles their ability to control.
Hamas hasn't confirmed his death. Meanwhile, health officials in Gaza say one person's been killed and 48 others injured outside an aid hub. Less than half the British public would support another strike by junior doctors. The BMA's begun balloting the medics, now known as resident doctors, for strike action that could last for 6 months. The union's leaders say they want the equivalent of a 29% pay rise. A survey by YouGov found 48% of British adults opposed more industrial action, 39% supported it. Former Conservative Health Minister Edwina Currie has told Times Radio she fears for the medical profession.
If we end up recruiting into our medical schools people whose main objective is money, then you've got the wrong kind of people as doctors. Let's just remind ourselves that last summer they got 22% from Wes Streeting, and they've just been given another 5.5% on top, which of course is worth more than 5.5% because it's on top of the 22%.
And the UK has recorded its sunniest spring on record with 4 days of the season still to go. The Met Office says we had around 630 hours of sunshine across the country between the beginning of March and yesterday. That's already exceeded the previous record by 4 hours set during the 2020 COVID lockdown. And remember, you can hear the Times' renowned foreign correspondents analyse the biggest global securities every day on our World in 10 podcast.
Across the UK on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, we all love the NHS, obviously, and we all support our medics and health workers, clearly, or we used to. Now, though, the doctors are balancing on strike action again in support of their pay demand of 29%. And there's a new poll that suggests less than half of us support the resident doctors, previously known as junior doctors, in their move towards strikes that could endure for 6 months. Now, with the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, apparently digging in for what could become a new drawn-out workplace battle on the wards, will the government be emboldened for the fight to come? A fight which, of course, will end with no winner and with no end of losers. I'll be talking live in a moment to our Times correspondents to get their inside take on the impact of striking on the NHS and the workings behind the scenes in Whitehall. So tell me, striking doctors, whose side are you on? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Share your thoughts. Let's look at it then. Less than half the British public, it seems, support junior doctors striking. It's a YouGov opinion poll, and they found that 39% of British adults back strikes. That's a change from last summer. More than half then would be in favour. And those results came as the British Medical Association ballots the resident doctors, formerly known as junior doctors, over whether to take 6 months of strikes. Now, the former Tory Health Minister, Edwina Currie, was very clear about her feelings on Times Radio earlier.
I don't think you can give in to them. I really don't. I don't think the government should have given in to them last summer because, you know, if you give in to strikers, all you're doing is inviting more strikes, which is exactly where we're at. I looked at the Times Online article about this. And there's a photo of the BMA resident doctors' new leaders, co-chairs Dr. Melissa Ryan and Dr. Ross Nieuwvoet. It's a Dutch name. And take a look at the photo. It's absolutely terrifying. They're both standing there looking extremely aggressive with their arms folded across their chests. They are not the kind of people you would want to be telling you that you've got cancer.
Edwina Curry there. Some pretty trenchant views, I think you'll agree. Let's talk, first of all, to Chris Smythe, Whitehall editor at The Times. Hi to you, Chris.
Hello, John.
Chris, can you just get us up to date on this opinion poll, please?
Yes, so this shows that, done by YouGov, show that more people oppose strike action than support it. Just 39% support it. And this is, of course, before any strike action has been begun. The doctors have opened their ballot, but we don't quite know where that is going to end up, although all of the rhetoric has been pretty punchy. So it is going to take, you know, something quite special to avert strikes, by the sound of it.
Really, really interesting numbers in that, yes, in that opinion poll. Do stay with us, Chris, if you would, because Eleanor Hayward, the Times health editor, is here with me in the studio. Hello to you, Eleanor. Welcome.
Hi.
Welcome back to the programme. Fair to say, Eleanor, that the junior doctors, the resident doctors, are in a militant mood?
Yeah, I think the mood's not really changed since last year. Among the leadership of the BMA junior doctors. But maybe I think there's some concern within the BMA about whether they'll get enough turnout to go on strike in this vote, because I think among the general population of doctors, they're feeling a bit lower appetite for going out on strike again.
That's really interesting information, though, Eleanor. If there's not a big enough turnout, you can read that as well. Whatever way you do read it, people may be very unhappy, but just not turning out in this particular ballot. But no great burning desire to take to the barricade again.
Yeah, it's hard to get a sense of what's going on, because obviously they took 44 days of strike action in 2023, 2024. And I think a lot of doctors hoped that that would be the end of it, getting the 22% pay rise. And now there's pressure from the BMA leadership to keep